Welcome to the Recruitment Leadership Podcast, hosted by Alison Humphreys. The Recruitment Leadership Podcast is here to help those in the recruitment industry gain awareness and understanding on the hot topics faced by those in the business of hiring people. In each episode, Alison Humphreys is joined by a fellow expert to offer professional knowledge, insight, and advice on the biggest subjects affecting recruitment businesses. It's the podcast to listen to for recruitment business frontrunners seeking expert information from industry-leading advisors. Welcome to the Recruitment Leadership Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Recruitment Leadership Podcast. I'm your host, Alison Humphreys, and I am excited today to be joined by Ollie Whiting, who is the CEO of LaFosse Associates. Welcome, Ollie. Main theme of our program today is about growth, adaptation, and taking a fresh look at how you do your job. And one of the reasons I was so excited to speak to Ollie about LaFosse is because, for those of you who aren't familiar with the brand, LaFosse is a genuine provider of a range of recruitment solutions. Now, it's a phrase, that phrase, recruitment solution, is one we see thrown about a lot in the industry. But actually, as you'll see, they have genuine differences in their in what they deliver. And that includes a full training academy for external people in coding. It's also a business that has enjoyed substantial growth. So I think there's a lot for our audience to learn from it. Just to put some data around that, LaFosse places in the technical environment, and Ollie's career, which started with Montash, another IT recruiter, when it was, I think you said, 4 staff, Ollie, and yeah, you grow right. It to 60. And in 2015, you joined LaFosse, formed by Simon LaFosse, when it had 70 people and an EBIT of 1.2 million. And just for scale, everybody, LaFosse now has more than 300 staff and last reported EBIT in excess of 7.6 million. So it's a substantial business. It's innovating. And today, Ollie's kindly agreed to share some of his insights into leadership and what's been involved in that growth. Okay. Ollie, was there anything I need to correct in introducing you? Is that accurate?
I think everything you've said is absolutely accurate, and I look forward to getting in and talking about recruitment solutions and putting some meat on the bones for that terminology that certainly is thrown around. So I'll do
it
my
is, best. Isn't it? Okay. Thank you. So LaFosse is one of the small percentage, and it is small, of recruitment businesses that has grown to an enterprise scale. And I'd like to start there. What, in your view, separates the founders and leaders from those who do succeed in doing this from those who don't and effectively end up, you know, operating with a much smaller team for the whole of their life cycle?
Yeah, it's a really good question, right? I think there's something like 44,000 recruitment companies out there. And there's only 50 of those with more than 200 staff. So we have this really unique industry that if you lined all of that onto a bar graph like that, that middle needle with headcount sticks out. And then we just have so many others around the SME and startup phase. And I think it's obvious to know why. It's quite low barriers of entry to get into the recruitment market. A lot of founders and leaders who are starting up in recruitment have had illustrious careers as successful individuals prior to setting up on their own, and therefore can you know, quite frankly, earn more money by going alone. But I do think what separates it from a scaling perspective and getting to an enterprise level largely comes down to, in my mind, kind of 3 things. First, it's around you're willing to delegate. Are you willing to hand over the controls of areas of the business to other people? With that, it's the second one, and it comes with trust. You know, the trust that you put into those individuals and the team that you're building around you to take on board those tasks that you're willing to delegate will enable growth. It'll enable you to focus on better things, things that you're good at, more strategic initiatives, more innovation, more entrepreneurial mindset, all the good stuff that helps you found the business in the first place. So once you've got a good chain of delegation, you've got the trust in the right individual. The third one for me, and I was thinking about this over the weekend, is I think it's around decisive decision making. And what do I mean by that is I think most successful entrepreneurs, founders, or leaders, operators of business, they might come from a background where they really only feel comfortable in making decisions with 100% of the information in front of them. But as you scale a business and you delegate more and you have to trust in others, you're not always going to have 100% of the information at your fingertips. So you need to be quite decisive with your decision making, and that work out what your threshold is for risk, and that differs per person. I am quite a risk averse leader in my mind, and my threshold is probably somewhere between 70 and 80%. So if I've got 70 or 80% of the information that leads to the decision I want to make, then I'm gone. And I've got to live with that mistake. I've got to live with that decision, even if it's the wrong decision. So look for whatever your threshold is and stick to that, because you can't have 100% of the information when you are number one employee. It's easy to make decisions because everything's based on your own mindset. You've got to kind of lower that threshold as you scale the business, and then stick with the decisions that you've made that are bad and live with them and ride them out and learn from them.
Okay, so really sound that some of the points you make there: delegation, trust, and being able to make a decision. And that's a particularly tricky thing to do in the business environment we find ourselves in today. I think it's probably more volatile and uncertain than it's been in most people's careers so far in recruitment, both on an international level and because of technological change and what's possible, what's going to stick, what's not going to, and so forth. So some really good points there. In my book, I wrote a chapter on this, and it was about successful people's willingness to dive in without knowing everything, even from the beginning. You mentioned a phrase that I quote there as well, the low barriers to entry in the recruitment industry. And in financial terms, it's true. There are very low barriers to entry out there. But I think my message would be, don't let that fool you into thinking you don't actually have to have some clarity about what you're going to do different and better than other people in your market. So you made this point about the importance of delegation. And I'm interested in, having seen this journey twice now at slightly different scales, once in Montage and once at Lafosse, what are the skills that you've observed need to be brought in from outside, typically, as a business grows?
I think this one really only came out of the mist for me probably in the last couple of years post-pandemic, linking to your points that you talked about just now. It's that we're in a volatile market. There's loads of compounding factors post-pandemic that makes it even more volatile. There's Gen AI, there's new technologies and trends. There's a different dynamic in the workforce at the junior end of the market that you're hiring. There's different generation needs coming through. The ability to be dynamic, agile, adaptable to those is front and center at the moment for most businesses, certainly definitely for most leaders. In terms of the scaling for me, I think the answer to this question, it really depends on your strengths as a leader. Being able to hire and bring in external experience against your weaknesses or development areas was fundamental for me. Why does it take a number of years for me to kind of work that out? It wasn't because I was kind of blind to what my development spots or development areas are. I think it's more around, you need an external person or a coach to give you the 360 honest feedback, someone who can work with your teams directly to get that feedback that they might not be telling you directly. Someone who's happy to speak to your customers to get their feedback, and then present you this picture, like a web diagram of all of your development areas, where your strengths are, you know, where you're really good at, and then where your weaknesses or your development areas are, and then hire against that. Scaffold against your development areas, hire better people than yourself into those areas. And I think that for me is really key. And I think getting that 360 review done up front from someone is worth all the money in the world, and then paying in to bring in those skill sets into your areas of development is fundamental.
I think that applies even if you have a leadership team. But interesting, when I work with usually much smaller businesses than LaFosse. If it's an entirely homegrown team, and you say, ask them, you're talking about the sales proposition, if you ask them, well, what do you do well? They imagine that they do everything very well. Yes.
Yeah.
Because they don't know what they don't know.
Yes.
Or how they genuinely compare. Of course, there's a narrative that is very helpful at the outset of a business about we're good at this, and you know, let's promote it to our potential customers and candidates. But to give a specific example without naming names, you know, I'm thinking about a business of mine that tells that I work with rather than when I've actually worked in that told me they were very successful at placing and had a very high penetration rate. Well, actually, they were only filling 1/10 of the vacancies that they worked. And actually, when I drilled down a little bit further, a lot of it was to do with their time to fill. And what they meant was, we put a lot of resource onto filling jobs, and we'll keep working them when other recruiters may have given up. But actually, there was a whole missing link there, because what they weren't doing was engaging with clients to explore why they hadn't filled them quicker and giving them any recommendations.
Yeah.
So they were, if you like, giving themselves a pat on the back for persistence, but it wasn't actually producing success. So it's just an interesting example of how people can be a little bit blinkered about their own successes.
Old definition of madness, isn't it? I think from Albert Einstein.
Yeah, that's the one. The other thing is about groupthink, isn't it? In early stage businesses, you would be an unusual business if the leader or founder did not influence the way people think. And that's a useful weapon, if you like, or tool in very early stage businesses. But interestingly, you know, and there's some very good profiling tools out there now. I've been involved and used these with some small leadership teams. And what it shows them in black and white is that actually they all have the same approach to a problem or a challenge, and that's maybe not the best way very often to approach things. So skills that you think need to be brought in, I guess what you're saying is it very much depends on what you yourself are good at. And what, if I may, what skills have you brought in to LaFosse? Are you able to comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of sense that's where the next question was going on this one as well. And I was just kind of reflecting on perhaps maybe some of the target audience of the podcast, and weighed up my own business and starting my business and what that looks like. But having also run teams that I've thought are, hey, these are amazing teams, because, you know, I've got four people who are reporting to me and they're all doing really well on the sales front. But that's because they come from that same commercial background as me. What I really noticed that as our business grew and we got more complex and diverse in terms of our offering to the market, size and scale, is that the areas of my development around operations and the run side of the business that needed to bring in external support to is it, of course, it makes sense. It's not my background, and bringing in that talent isn't something that we've been afraid to do and invest in that operational head that when you're a smaller business, you might not have the pockets, money, liquidity to do so. But you know, everything I'm talking to is lived experience from stuff that we've failed at or not done well at, myself personally or us as a business. And us being able to invest in, you know, some really good operational leaders has helped move the needle on the business and drive us forward.
You, LaFosse, is one of the few recruiters in the great scheme of things who've actually moved beyond your original competency of placing individuals in one-off jobs. Yeah, it would be very helpful if you could just talk our listeners through the different solutions that you now offer, and explain to us why you decided to make that investment and change.
I think diversifying our portfolio offering is something we kind of talk about in our annual planning, quarterly, monthly, and keeping that entrepreneurial spirit front and center. Whether that's like when we're a traditional recruitment business, that's just what's the next new vertical look like, what do the new desks look like, and that we're starting up. But if I fast forward, it's kind of like customer led is where we want to be with our decisions. I think where we've fallen down before is very people led decision making. You know, someone wants to go and do the new shiny thing. Okay, let's do that. We back that person. They're a great person to get behind. I think you need an element of that, definitely, in a business. It keeps that entrepreneurial mindset. It's great for inspiring talent, it's great for retaining talent. So I would definitely recommend on keeping that people-led decision-making, but also weigh that up with customer-led decisions. What are our customers saying? Where are their pain points in the market? What are you doing to actually solve their problems? And then trying to do that in the most efficient, quickest way possible for your customer is what's going to help them come back for more, basically. And I think that's what's driven our diversification from our offering of being, you know, we were founded as an exec search business, diversifying into the contingent recruitment world, then looking to expand internationally, adding our train and deploy business, looking at a solutions business, you know. And I know that there's a lot of companies out there kind of weighing these offerings up at the moment, but it's kind of like, if I had my time again on a lot of our entrepreneurial decision making, I think, you know, the biggest piece of advice is around really putting the customer at the heart of it. And is it a customer-led decision that you're making, or is it a people-led decision?
One of the challenges of doing that for a lot of listeners, I imagine, will be that if their entire experience is only in, for example, you know, spot recruitment business, it's actually, you're familiar with the phrase, if you've only got a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Yeah. And it's actually quite hard for them to have a conversation and understand the wider business context that people are trying to address. But what we do know from having these conversations at a senior level is that people do not see recruitment as an isolated thing in itself, do they? They look at skills for the future. They're looking at their customer base and saying, well, what is it we need? And yeah, we might have to hire some of it in, but also how can we develop it?
Yeah.
Which is why I was so interested in your development of the academy, because instead of phoning clients and telling them there's candidate skill shortages, you are actually doing something about it and contributing on a national level now to building the skills profile, the workforce. And it's not an easy thing to do, but most recently, regular listeners will know we had Dee Dee Doak, the editor of Recruiter magazine, as a guest, and she was saying that to really make a difference in the recruitment space now, people who currently run recruitment businesses will need to be thinking about the wider skills agenda. Would you be able to give our listeners a bit of an insight into what the Academy does and what the challenges have been around that?
So I think you kind of summarized it nicely in terms of what it does. Our Academy essentially is a boot camp, a 12-week course where we will look to train, develop, and then deploy junior talent into the tech market. And tech market is quite broad. It might be tech change and transformation, because that's where we specialize in our recruitment offering. And we are trying to tackle the ongoing challenge of shortages in the market, specifically for diverse talent, talent that may come from a lower socioeconomic background. They might not have the desired education. They may be second jobbers looking for career moves. Trying to create an opportunity for a more diverse set of thinking at the entry level of those markets. Why? Because in our recruitment business model, that's the demand. That's what we were hearing when we have 1,200 contractors out in the market in our recruitment business, and you know, we're doing 40 or 50 permanent placements per month. You know, it's our customers who are saying, you know, this is all well and good, and hey, LaFosse, you're doing a great journey, but I've got a long-term problem. To your point at the start, they're not looking for a recruitment offering to just come and fix a six-month problem. They really want to solve problems on their 3 to 4 year plan. And back to our conversation at the start, with the market being volatile, with us being in a point of change, people really want to shore up the future by securing the next future leaders and future talent coming into the business, versus over-indexing and relying on, you know, a contingent workforce that may rotate every 6 to 9 months in the contracting market.
So when you made that decision to invest in an academy, and unless I'm very much mistaken, the rewards are quite back-ended for that. You've got to put a lot of investment up front before you start to see profit from it. How did you go about, just the initial stages, how did you go about spotting buying spotting opportunities with your clients and
Yeah.
or promoting that as a service?
So I think this goes for any new business startup within a business. So if you're looking at launching and investing in something that's outside of your core product, so a product extension, it's really around is have you got the right MI from your customers that show that there's actually a problem that your solution can solve. If you don't have that, there's nothing to invest in, despite what you may be hearing from the business, what you may be feeling as an entrepreneur. Yeah, I genuinely believe it starts with, have you got the MI and data that's really saying from the customers, this is the problem I'm trying to solve? And then you can kind of work out how much you're willing to invest in it. And then the ultimate question of when do you expect that return? And I think that, most people go into the product extension or launching new businesses perhaps without clarity on all of those three. Us certainly, we fall into that category. That's why I say we're in a really good place now with nearly 200 associates out. We're making an impact. We're trying to change the narrative in the market like we're doing at the moment, but we're by no means, we're only scratching the surface. We want to really be out, instead of we've got 700 recruitment customers and 30 academy customers. We should have a much more diverse academy portfolio of customers, and that's what we're trying to do at the moment. And that's because it's not an easy solution for customers to buy. It's complex. It can look like a big investment with little return. So you've got to really work closely with the customers that it's right for. And I think, as I said, that's the same for academy, or that's the same for a startup of another business. It could be a statement of work business, like a solutions business within a recruitment company. I think the same goes. It's like, have you got the data from the customer around the problems that it's going to solve? And the customers who are willing to partner you at the start when you've never done it before.
That is a such a powerful point that the customer has to understand what, I guess what you're saying is what it's
Yeah.
costing them not to solve this problem,
Yes.
and how they would measure a successful solution. Yeah,
Yes.
brilliant. Interestingly, I have been as an advisor involved in a number of cases where people have gone from spot business to try and win sole supplier or even statement of works
Yeah.
deals. And one of the key things is that whole, sorting out the two-way SLA so that the customer understands they're going to have to change their modus operandus as well as us. And in their enthusiasm, I know a number of business owners who've just gone, yeah, and started offering people discounts before the client has done their
Yeah.
end,
Yeah.
but then
Look,
they haven't got the
we've
tools.
been yeah, we've been there. It's a painful place to be, and I don't think many successful businesses would have got to where they are without doing some of that. These are just some of the hurdles that if you can avoid, that you should avoid, because they'll really slow you down by about 3 to 6 months.
You've raised the importance of having a diversity of skills in your
Yeah.
business and also for everyone to be customer-led. So how do you ensure that with the day-to-day pressures that all recruitment businesses have, or those who start in recruitment, how do you ensure that your team keep their periscopes up? Listeners will have heard me use that phrase a lot, and
Yes.
are actually open to hearing those needs.
You've got to, I was thinking about this question. I think you've got to make sure that your leaders have the space to have their periscopes up. I've certainly been guilty before of not giving the space to allow for the periscopes to be up, because the right here, right now needs fixing. There's always urgent issues and fires that need putting out. And the problem with what seems like urgent issues and fires that need putting out, which can be customer-led sometimes, and it does require quite front-footed leadership to manage customer expectations, that things that you might not be able to deliver, you might have to turn things down in order to create that space to keep the periscopes up of your leadership team. That's the only way new ideas and diversity of thought will kind of come to that table in your strategy meeting, if you can lift up to look away from the from the now to the future. And some of the practical things that you can do to create that space is obviously, some of the obvious is about where your fixed cost base is, and have you got enough breathing room month to month to be able to think longer term. And then the second of all is, like, are you focused on you know, internally hiring the best people and sticking true to that. One of the key things that you want to get right when delegating, to the answers I gave at the top of the interview, it's like, you know, if you can really pass down and delegate out great hiring processes and onboarding and identification of good talent, if you wrap that around a great culture, then a lot of the business growth can look after itself. You can focus on periscopes up, looking for new ideas, new market territory.
Some business owners I know have found it helpful to actually get their people out to networking events, but not necessarily in the recruitment industry, more in the sector that they serve. So list be to be at conferences just as a listener, rather than being out there, you know, shelling out the business cards as if they were going out of fashion. And personally, I mean, there's a lot of good quality data that is freely available. But it takes time to study, doesn't it? And you mentioned when we spoke earlier, you mentioned about making it a regular agenda item in your team meetings, that like, what is new? Where could we go next? Because I know on occasions I've seen people ask relatively inexperienced consultants to present an entire business plan before they're prepared to look at any further at a new idea. Very often these people won't have the skills to do that.
Yes.
The other issue that is very topical right now, we've mentioned already, it's the volatile environment we're in, financially, politically, technologically. How do you, as a leader, plan in that environment?
It's definitely harder. I think there's things that, some practical things is, first of all, it's like no one can plan for a pandemic and how quickly that hit us and impacted the market. I think when the buoyant 2022 was happening and people were, you know, making money for fun and placements and buoyant market, lots of really good recruitment activity happening, I think those of us with more experience knew what was coming around the corner, that, you know, this is like a time, if you looked at then GDP growth over the 4 years, you looked at hiring trends over 4 years and not 2 years, you kind of saw what was coming last year in terms of a tightening market. So I think there's definitely historic trends that can give leaders some comfort in their decision making and planning. There's some that's just way out of their control, you know, whether a pandemic comes around the corner really quickly, I do think we'll be better equipped to deal with it. There's the coaching and the external coaching and that impact that it can have on your business leader and leadership team. Let's see the value that people out of industry can really have in terms of leveling up your skill set and thought processes, helps you plan much more effectively for the future. Kind of feeds back to what you were saying there about, you know, attending conferences to just basically create more innovation of thought to bring back to base. I like the saying that I think external coaches can help add that value into a business as well. And that helps you plan for the future, mitigate against downside. And I think as long as it's carefully managed centrally, and you're really close to it as a CEO, it can have a really big impact.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, isn't it? I think one has to be careful about how many external advisors at any one time you involve in your business. But I've certainly found it very helpful in a couple of situations to appoint an advisory board. And those are people who are very senior in the sectors that recruitment business was servicing, often sort of semi-retired, looking for a bit more of a portfolio career, but people who had enough experience and seniority to be able to see emerging patterns, as opposed to this weird thing happened to me last week. And I found those people give invaluable input into the mindset of the industry you're trying to serve.
Yeah, I'd agree. To kind of also flip that on its head though a little bit, you know, we became employee owned in 2023, which was kind of the next chapter of our growth, and we have an employee advisory board, employee ambassador panel as they're called. And whilst we've tended to be pretty good on the side of listening to our teams, and we have different tools and techniques to gather their feedback throughout the week and pulse checks and some of the you know, wonderful tools that are out there to enable that. Having a formal employee board that comes back with innovation of thought, that contributes and understands enterprise value and how to drive enterprise value, for me, you kind of then have two schools of thoughts. You get the group who you were referring to NEDs, chairs, external advisors who can come in with that innovation of thought and experience. And then you have this employee board that not only knows your business very well, they're on the ground speaking to customers, candidates, and their colleagues every day. So you then have two rich sources of data coming back. And the reason I was saying, you know, we're employee ownership and we have that. The reason I'm saying that is you don't need to be an employee-owned business to have what is an employee ambassador panel, an employee advisory board. But I think they are invaluable in terms of the experience that they'll give you to help them run and lead your business.
Wow. Okay. Now that's completely original. We haven't come across that before on this podcast. To give people an idea, what's the size of that employee advisory board?
Yeah, of course. Seven people.
Mm-hmm.
You want to ensure that they're representative of the headcount from across the business. So, you know, if you're a 50-person company and you've got a 40-person sales team and a 10-person operations team, you don't want to have an employee ambassador panel that's just all sales. Mm-hmm. You won't get the innovation of thought and diversity of thought that you're looking for, as well as how people are feeling on the ground. So you want to have a makeup representative headcount. You want to represent each division, and you want to have a cadence that they meet. You want to have a training for them so they understand what enterprise value is and growth.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be surprised at how quickly people do get it and how quickly their change of thought process comes into play and they start thinking like business owners. And then they start coming to the table with ideas that you and your leadership team won't have. That's mm-hmm. because you're not as close to the market and to the customers as leaders we like to think that we are, that we're not, because, you know, the reality is of running a business is a full-time job. So you need that innovation of thought coming up from the grassroots level.
I love this. So did you actually set up a transparent application process to be on that board, or?
That's a good question. Yeah, we had 43 applications, manifestos, and then each division votes for their the representative that they would like to have on that panel.
Right.
Panel set up, and they meet with a similar agenda to the board meeting. And you know that you've got to be really open and have the mindset you can be transparent with your financials, with your numbers, with your setup. There's absolutely no reason why other companies can't do this. You know, you don't need to be employee owned to have this innovation of thought and a real think tank that's at the heart of your business.
I love that you actually gave people some training about enterprise, because I have seen some well-intentioned attempts to do something like this. I mean, they weren't actually employee-owned organizations, but they were trying to be very democratic. And without that training, you can end up, can't you, with people who just at the end of every meeting submit a list of further expensive demands.
New coffee machine, 4-day holiday week, 4-day week.
Yeah.
Do you know what? Look, and that none of that came to the table. Our fear as leaders was that, oh, that's what it's going to be. It's just going to be more cost on the business. And it's really not. It comes down to that trust and delegation, because the right people who come forward for this role will tend to be commercially thinking. They'll want what's best for the business. There'll be company people. There'll be people who want to drive up enterprise value for the business. Mm-hmm. They'll be focused on retaining great people. And these are all things that drive up enterprise value. So, you know, they're not going to be talking about the 4-day working week and new coffee machines here and there. It tends to be really good innovation for thought of ideas. And also, like, hey, have you thought about the impact of this decision that you're thinking of as a board? You know, and sometimes it's just a great sounding board.
So you've also got involved with international markets at Lafosse.
Mm. Yeah.
What in your view did you do well in this arena, and did you make any mistakes?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we absolutely have made mistakes. We've the biggest mistake of going internationally is from my side is two things. Is one is being people led with your decision making, and second of all, having this false assumption that because what we do well in one market is just going to land easily in another market. And it's really tough, because often the people led decision makings, and I've had this in you know, the two places that I've been working and have led, is that you want to retain good people, and sometimes good people want to go internationally to do something new and exciting, and therefore you kind of give them the tools and the platform to do it. But it just doesn't work out because it's very hard to start over again in a new market with no brand, no customers. Your experience that you've had in one market, it just might not be as transferable to a new market. So being people-led with the decision can sometimes be risky. Hey, look, sometimes it pays off, right? And there's plenty of good companies out there who have expanded internationally that have made it work from being people-led decisions. But you can be customer-led first, and even if it's grassroots, and have some shoots of new customers in that market, and then hire a leader, a really good leader around that, then the business becomes easier to scale.
Yeah. So have you gone down that route of hiring leaders in the geography that you're placing?
Yes.
So a lot of businesses I know are now working, or wish they were working, in the US market, where there are obviously the fee dynamics and the salaries are all slightly different. I know you guys aren't doing that. Could you just tell our audience which countries you are operating in currently?
Yeah, and it's not that we aren't out of choice. You know, we have had a few successful years in the US with an offering that we had, but we were very dispersed. A number of consultants spread across a massive geographic region just made it very impossible to manage and scale, in all honesty. So, you know, we had people on the West Coast, people on the East Coast, people in Central. So it's kind of like really tough to scale that business around a few really good people, some who are ex-UK employees, some who are hired on the ground. So we kind of fast forward to today. We you know, one of the things I kind of was really passionate about doing was launching our offering into Europe, because we had green shoots there. We already had customers that we were partnering. So it made sense finding a really good leader in Amsterdam, a gentleman called Ville. And then, you know, in the case of the first 18 months, he's managed to build a team. We're off the ground and scaled there. We've kind of got plans for another office this year. Can't announce the location just yet because the ink's not dry. And then look, we'll revisit the US. It's a massive market. I mean, we'll revisit that and probably in 2025. We've got a lot to do in terms of getting our UK and European offering tightened up, get our academy scaled up, and then look to probably launch in 25 if we can find the right person to build around.
So coming to a close very shortly, it's very difficult, I think, for recruitment businesses to have, or at least to have and keep, any genuine point of difference. I mean, the figures were all there. You quoted 44,000 different recruitment businesses in the UK alone. What, in your view, makes Lafosse distinctive? And is there, added to that, is there anything that makes your leadership distinctive?
The culture and values of which, you know, Simon founded the business on, and genuinely being people-led and caring as a value and an ethos of how we've run this business. It's what's attracted good people over the years. It's what attracted me into the business 9 years ago, and it's kind of still at the heart and center of what we do. And caring doesn't always mean being, you know, nice and soft. I think there's kind of associated with that, but you know, I do like to think that we are nice and caring and definitely empathetic, but it also means having the tough conversations with people when you need to. And we've kind of built a really successful business on values. And if we continue to hire good people against those values and keep that at the core of our hiring, then I think the rest becomes easier, because you get the right people working for you. And it's not appropriate for everyone. Not everyone wants to work in a business that is so values-led and has such a strong culture. And sometimes it can be quite unfamiliar for experienced hires to join us, and not everybody's cup of tea. But keeping honest and keeping your culture and values front and center for me has been definitely one of the things that stands out for us. It's what all experienced hires recite is what makes us different. And it's kind of that then echoes to our customers. You know, they notice that we care more. We're trying to fix their problems and solutions. We're not trying to do spot business, get in and get out. We are trying to solve their longer term problems. And that comes if you hire the right people and create the environment and culture for them to succeed.
Yeah. Now, you make a really interesting point there about values led. Because as an organization grows, those values really do have to be reinforced and sometimes put in writing, don't they? They cannot just be osmosed, because they will always lose something in translation, in my experience. Yeah. Interestingly, I've done a lot of work with and spoken to more business leaders who say they are building a values-led business. And then when you ask them, okay, you've got these values on your website, where did they come from? They'd say, well, I just wrote them down. You know, they just literally pulled some words. Rather than actually consulted with their team and looked at, well, is this real? What does it look like in action?
Yes.
We've spoken on previous podcasts about interviewing for values, which listeners might want to go look up. So thank you for that. Can I finish with a final question? Mm. Any predictions for this year?
A change of government, I think, will happen. A tough first two quarters, whilst business restructure, gear themselves up for a next chapter of growth. I think 2024 will be quite telling. It will be working out who got through 2023 unscathed, managed to restructure their businesses, get themselves on the front foot, ready for a recovery, and which weren't quick enough in terms of their decision making. And the hangover of 2023 just means a really tough 2024. You know, and I'm an optimistic person. I think most businesses will look to ramp up hiring in the second half of this year. And I think from a talent perspective in the recruitment sector, once we have a change of government and the market shifts a bit, I think that we'll be on the front foot.
Okay, great. And that's a fantastic place to finish. Now, I know some listeners will want to be in touch with Lafosse. So Ollie, how should they contact you, or is there someone else they should contact if they're interested in exploring any subject with you?
For sure, yeah. And I always willing to help where I can. They can drop me an email to my email address, ollie.whiting@lafosse.com. And if I don't get back right away, I'll be sure to get back. I get back to all of my emails. So I'll do my best to help in any way I can.
Okay, that's brilliant. Ollie, thank you very much for being a fabulous guest with loads of actionable points. And I know people will want to listen to the story from such a successful and now diverse business. So this has been the Recruitment Leadership Podcast. Thank you for joining us, Ollie. Thank you, listeners, for joining us yet again. I'm Alison Humphreys, and hope to see you next time.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Alison. Best of luck, everybody, for 2024.
You've been listening to the Recruitment Leadership Podcast. If you enjoyed our podcast, please subscribe, review and share so that others can find the podcast too. We really appreciate your support. If you have any questions about the topics covered or wish to find out more about recruitment leadership, please email alison@recruitmentleadership.co.uk, referencing the podcast. We're also on LinkedIn, where you can follow Recruitment Leadership and connect with Alison Humphreys. Thank you for listening, and we hope you join us next time for another episode of the Recruitment Leadership Podcast.